Good evening. Well, we've come to the end of Uji. I feel very sad about it. I've had a wonderful time with this. It scared me to start it. I really did it sort of to dare myself, because it's such a profound work and so inscrutable. And yet, it seemed important for us to try to go inside in this way. We could do it many, many more times and learn a lot each time. So there's no definitive way to study it. I've read a lot online of people's discussion of this one work of Dogen's, and it's amazing how many different takes there are on this one little small document. People see many, many different things in it. So for you yourselves, each one of you is catching something from it. But it may not be the same thing that your neighbor is catching. So please allow yourself the pleasure of going back and seeing what else is there. I always find that the material that has real truth in it can be returned to over and over, and it's new each time and has some new thing to teach us. It's almost a test of Dharma. If it's just the same old stuff, then you think, well, there are a lot of things that in our youth helped us a lot, but that don't relate so much maybe 20 years later. But the Dharma will keep relating year after year. There's something alive in it. So we have a last little bit. Which I have called number 10. Which is very short. So he's been talking about mind and words. Both mind and words are the time being in number 9. Arriving and not arriving are time being. And so he keeps bringing up, it's this and it's this. Usually our mind works that we have to choose this one or this one. This has got to be true, this one's not. But in our practice, we begin to realize that bring one side up, there's another side. There's always another side. So arriving, not arriving. Sometimes the mind arrives, but words do not arrive. Sometimes words arrive and the mind does not. So he's just playing with this whole conception of how stuck we can get on one way of seeing things. So in number 10, he says, the old masters have thus uttered these words, but is there nothing further to say? And then he has this little reprise, really, almost the same. Mind and words arriving partway are the time being. Mind and words not arriving partway are the time being. He says, in this manner you should examine the time being. And another little set. To have him raise the eyebrows and blink is half the time being. To have him raise the eyebrows and blink is the time being missed. Not to have him raise the eyebrows and blink is half the time being. Not to have him raise the eyebrows and blink is the time being missed. Thus, says Dogen, to study thoroughly coming and going, and to study thoroughly arriving and not arriving, is the time being of this moment. Written on the first day of winter, the first year of the Ninji era, 1240. Written at the Kosho Horin Monastery. I had something else to share with you, but I'm not sure I brought it with me. Nope, I didn't. But what I'd like to do is review this a little bit. Well, here's a bit. Here's something of Katagiri. Too many papers. So all of these things, arriving and not arriving, are about activity. And you can look at this whole piece on Uji, as many of Dogen's pieces, as addressing activity. It's very interesting to study Buddhism. And it's a very deep subject and extremely attractive to certain kinds of minds. And we can spend hours and days and years studying Buddhism. But it's an experience, not an idea. And it's an activity. It isn't thinking about what to do. It's actually the complete commitment to action. It's using the life and the energy that we're born with and completely committing to our life, whatever it is. Sometimes it looks like it has to have a certain shape and form, and there's some that are more perfect than others, and then we try to live up to them or feel shame because we haven't got there yet. Or there's so many permutations of this thing about having some kind of goal, some sort of object for which we are striving. And all the while, we're neglecting what's really here. The one place and the one time, which is your time and my time. So Katagiri says the result of activity is not, the result of activity is not the important point. The important point is activity itself. Within activity, there is a most important motivation called total samadhi or nirvana. So you can deal with everyday activity in terms of oneness. What does this mean? Your body and your mind must be flexible. When you're flexible, you're totally absorbed into your activity, and that is called samadhi. If you try to absorb yourself as your subject, yourself as your subject, into activity as your object, it's not total absorption. This is me, and look at me, I'm cutting this onion. Aren't I doing a good job? No, I'm not doing it. Oh, I should have done it. All of that is creating a kind of tension between yourself and yourself. Because at that point, you are the onion and the knife and the table and the whole thing happening. And if you give yourself to it, then the whole thing goes. It flows, as Dogen says in this, in Uji. that we, if we give ourselves to what we're doing, that the whole thing flows by itself. To be completely absorbed, you have to devote yourself totally with sincerity. So I think mostly we hold ourselves back, mostly because of the conditioning that we have, the voices that we have inside ourselves, saying, oh, you're not good enough, or you could do better, or what's the matter with you, or all those things that we've been conditioned by. That get in the way of actually being where we are and doing what we're doing. Self-consciousness, self-beratement, or self-hubris also. Look what a great job I'm doing. I'm the best onion slicer in the whole country. Or what? He said, to be completely absorbed, you have to devote yourself totally, with sincerity. And then you can be absorbed. You can see the unity of your body, your mind, and your object. So then the where and the when is all of a piece. That's what's meant by oneness. We think of oneness as some huge thing, but it's oneness right in place and time, right in the moment where we are. What we do is oneness. We enact ourselves as oneness with everything. So I went through this afternoon, sort of enjoying it a little bit as I skimmed through it, and I thought I would just pick up a few things to remind you of just as we pass it by and kiss it goodbye. The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. See each thing in this entire world as a moment of time. Things do not hinder one another, just as moments do not hinder one another. The way-seeking mind arises in this moment. The self setting itself out in array sees itself. This is the understanding that the self is time. It's amazing to think things don't hinder each other. Each thing has its own place and its own time, including us. We don't bump into each other's time. And each time isn't exactly the same as the other's time. Each view isn't exactly the same as the other's view. We could look at this group, and each one of us, although we're looking in the same general direction at the same thing, are all seeing something different, each one. So nothing is hindering anything. Everything is flowing already, even though it feels like we're sort of bumping up against things. We're not. Know that in this way there are myriad of forms and hundreds of grasses throughout the entire world, and yet each grass and each form itself is the entire world, Earth. The study of this is the beginning of practice. the beginning, the middle, and the end, I would say. I think we go back over and over. What is this before me? How can I understand this before me? And ask it. Tell me your truth. So often we confront whatever's before us and start saying what we think we know, expressing our opinions, and having already a judgment about what it is. Oh, that's just one of millions of grasses. I don't even care about it so much, and etc. But actually, to ask the grass, tell me your truth. Who are you? For all things and all beings that we meet. Then again, life flows. It doesn't stop with us. We allow it to move. We allow things to move between us and what seems like everything else. It takes some courage to live this way. It feels safer, although it's not, it feels safer to withhold ourselves and try not to know too much about anything else. To be too intimate is calls ourself into question, our self-image. We protect our self-image by not getting too close. And of course, we always talk about how to be safe and how to recognize danger when it's there. But in this sense that I'm talking about, it's not about opening all the doors and windows. It's about allowing what's here to exist with us. That the being time of ourself is the same being time as whatever we are with, by, for, in, of. Each moment is all being, is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. And then it gets silly because you can't, it's all here. You can't say, well, it's all here except that star way over there somewhere. Or that star's light, we could say. Maybe that star is gone, actually. Time is not separate from you, and as you are present, time does not go away, even though it feels like it. The moment, time is not marked by coming and going. You are the time being right now. Although the views of an ordinary person and the causes and conditions of those views are what the ordinary person sees, they are not necessarily the ordinary person's truth. The truth merely manifests itself for the time being as an ordinary person. Because you think your time or your being is not truth, you believe that the 16-foot golden body is not you. However, your attempts to escape from being the 16-foot golden body are nothing but bits and pieces of the time being. Those who have not yet confirmed this should look into it deeply. Just actualize all time as all being. There is nothing extra. I always think that's such good news. There's nothing extra. Vigorously abiding in each moment is the time being. Do not mistakenly confuse it as non-being. Do not forcefully assert it as being. So here's one of the many places where he presents a notion and then makes sure to qualify it by saying, but don't get caught by that. Even though this is a truth, don't be caught by that truth, because then it isn't true anymore. Don't forcefully assert it. Don't mistakenly confuse it. In other words, keep your mind flexible. Keep it open and interested and curious and willing to change as information changes, as the moment changes, as it flows. People only see times coming and going and do not thoroughly understand that the time being abides in each moment. And then he says, even if people did recognize it, who could give expression to this recognition? How can you even talk about it? And even if they could talk about it, for a long time, who could stop looking for the realization of the original face of enlightenment itself? According to an ordinary person's view, this kind of talking about what it could possibly be and finding words for it is just mere aspects of coming and going. Just stuff. The time being of all beings throughout the world, in water and on land, is just the actualization of your complete effort right now. All beings are the time being actualized by your complete effort, flowing due to your complete effort. Closely examine this flowing. Without your complete effort right now, nothing would be actualized, nothing would flow. So you see, he's giving us little homework all the way through here. Study this. Closely examine this. Go home and really think about this. It's very helpful because these are not easy to take in. In your study of flowing, if you imagine the objective environment to be outside yourself, and that you flow and move through hundreds and thousands of worlds for hundreds, thousands, and myriads of eons, you have not devotedly studied the Buddha way. Mind is the moment of actualizing the fundamental point. Words are the moment of going beyond, unlocking the barrier. Arriving is the moment of casting off the body. Not arriving is the moment of being one with just this, while being free from just this. In this way, you must endeavor to actualize the time being. I found a very interesting quote from Carl Bielefeld, who was having a discussion about time with some people, and he said, well, it seems like it's just one damn thing after another all through your life. And he said, and all along, there's a great upwelling of enlightenment throughout the world. That's what Dogen is talking about. Discussion? Questions? Sally.
Something is hanging me up. I mean, I can kind of get the gist, the overall view of all of this, that we're not supposed to think in terms of binaries or dichotomies, that things flow, and that we're not, there is this boundary that we set up between ourselves and what we call the other, which is everything that is not us. And then I noticed this dichotomous relationship being set up between ideas and experience. But aren't they as well?
Yep.
Opposites, or create a whole, so that we can't say necessarily ideas are bad in and of themselves and experience is all good in and of itself, but they create a whole, that they feed into each other. That ideas and experience need each other.
That's what he means about words. Mm-hmm. That words are essential to understanding. But we can get hooked by them, and then they don't help at all. So the only way is to value extremely the ideas and the words without holding on to any of it, and letting them flow so that we're not stuck somewhere. And of course, we do get stuck. And we get thrilled by an idea and we claim it as our own. And sometimes it gets pretty intense before we're able to let go. But the point is that if we really want to know what's true, we have to let them go, because they're all provisional. They're all very, very weakly pointing to something that we can't say.
Well, they are guideposts or approximations of experience. Experience can ground ideas. Am I making any sense?
I'm not sure I understand. A guidepost, when I talk about a finger pointing, I think it's more like that than a guidepost. It's just trying to shock us into a view, a vision. There's a kind of eye of truth that often we don't exercise, we don't use, and we forget where it is and how to do. And so the Dharma is trying to encourage us toward that in some way. And the words help, but the words also are a tremendous hindrance if we get caught by them. So a lot of material is to say, you know, respect the words, but please study it, so that you know where they came from. Ron?
What does he think? Where did the words come from? It sort of reminds me of the beginning of the Tao Te Ching, where they something like, yeah, name of those, the origin of heaven and earth, but the name of those is the root of everything. But he doesn't. That's kind of the dilemma, because we don't know where it all started.
That's right.
But in order to understand it, we have to, the way our minds work, we seem to have to be able to hang words on it.
Well, that's one way that our mind works, and of course it's extremely valuable. It's our genius as human beings. But if we only go by the words, we're way off base. We're really lost. And it's only the experience of not knowing, of not saying, that we can experience the truth of things. And then from that, if there's an experience of insight, a wordless insight, then we begin to scramble around and try to find the words for it, right? And try to pin it down and make it into something, often make it into something to enhance my own self-image. Oh, I had this experience. This must be really important. So it's a tricky thing.
Like you said, we make the words, we kind of bring them into existence because our mind works, but we should let go of these words and go back to just the source, which is kind of beyond words.
Yes, but we do have. There is a number of ways of speaking. There's the sort of ordinary, everyday, sort of shallow talk that we all do. You know, it's a nice day today, and tomorrow it's going to be cold, or something like that. Or there's speaking truth, which is a whole different level of speech. And that speech, we don't know where it comes from, and we don't know what we're going to say until we say it. So that is one of those places where it flows and where we abandon ourselves to it. It's not us anymore. Samia?
Sometimes you wonder how simple is it. I mean, we talk about it being really simple. I was teaching today my 7-year-old, and she's full of energy, but finally I got her settled and she started playing, and I was looking at her. Of course she can't see me, and I'm just really looking at her and paying attention to what she's playing, and I'm thinking, I wonder what she's thinking. And then she's playing, and she goes, "You're watching me, aren't you?"
She could feel it.
And, I mean, she's 7 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, people tell me, oh, you know, I saw them in the market. Oh, I felt this. Like, what are they talking about, you know? And I said, "You're scary." She goes, "I know." You know, it is. You know, it's so simple. It's like when you pay attention for 1 second, it comes right back at you.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I didn't have to do anything. She was playing her lesson. I was just, you know, listening and just kind of looking at her. So is it really that simple?
Yes. Yeah. There's a story in the Lotus Sutra about a little girl who pops up and is enlightened, and they all say, oh, she can't be enlightened, she's just a little 7-year-old girl. And then she makes them eat their words. So, yes, it is that simple, but difficult. Difficult to stay awake to it. And we just drift off into our own sort of dream world. And then sometimes we wake up and pay attention again. But every time we do, then it wakes us up a little bit more too. It's a wonderful story. It's after 8. I'm going to be gone next week. I'm going to New Mexico, as usual, at this time of year, to do an ordination, a Jukai, with Sue Goldberg. I'm really looking forward to it. And I was invited after the session to Albuquerque, where I have to go anyway for the airplane, to spend the weekend and give a talk on Monday night to the Desert Mirror Sangha, which is a new little sangha. It's an offshoot of San Francisco Zen Center. A couple of priests have moved out there and have created this, looks like on their website, really pretty place. So I'll give the Monday night talk and then catch an early plane on Tuesday, and I'll be here the next Tuesday, assuming the airplanes all do what they're supposed to do. So in the meantime, I've made a list of some of the things that I thought we might consider to talk about. And Donna Lynn has offered to, since she knows so much about these, she studied almost all of these things, and so she can share with you what they are, give a sense of their flavor, so that you can discuss them next week.